Welcome back to the Fitness Stuff for Normal People podcast. I'm Tony.
And I'm Mariana.
And the fitness industry right now is not what it could be. It's become something built on everything and anything that can grab your attention for clicks, for money, really just directing attention away from what actually matters. The bottom line is we're not just trying to provide another fitness podcast. There are enough of those, but completely change the fitness industry for the better by giving you the knowledge and tools so you have the confidence in applying the best possible training and nutrition into your own life. Where today, in perfect line with our intro, we are doing part one of a two-part series uncovering the top 10 fitness trends in the fitness industry that are 100% waste of money. I'm talking straight up scams that could be saving you hundreds, if not thousands of dollars over the course of just a few months. Today, we're going to break down the top five on that list with science and research to explain why these are not worth your time and if there are better options for whatever you're trying to solve because of that. Before we get started, y'all know how to make us happy, make us smile, jump in our seats. You can drop us a five-star review on whatever platform you are listening on. And even better, if you're listening on Spotify, you can go to our homepage, hit the little follow button. We're reaching almost 25K over there, which we'll probably do a giveaway in celebration for. But that's the easiest way you can support us. It's free. It takes 10 seconds. You can do it right now.
And if you want more after each episode, you can join us on Fitness Stuff Premium for just $5 a month, where you get a bonus episode every single Friday where we answer your own specific questions. We also have full training programs on there, like our high frequency full body program, ultimate push pull leg program, our newest 12-week glute growth program, or you could choose an upper body focused program if that's what you're looking to do, focusing on your chest, back, delts, and arm growth without leaving the legs behind, because we still want to focus on those. And yes, you also get other sick perks like entry into our Legion supplement giveaways, exclusive discounts for companies like Oura Ring, high-end blood work from Merrick Health, and much more. You can go ahead and sign up in the show notes below. And before we get into it, quick shout out to the sponsor of today's episode, Legion Athletics, our kind of day ones at this point. So I think that's telling about how we view them and our partnership with them. And we just cannot recommend them to you enough. 100% of their supplements are backed by a scientific review board. They are all third-party tested and they have a no questions asked money back guarantee. You can get 20% off your first order or double points on every order after that. Use FS Pod or use the link in our show notes below. Let's get into it.
Let's get into it.
For today's episode.
I know. I don't think I love anything more than highlighting a company, a person, someone else who's taking advantage of people that people aren't super aware of. Nothing just kind of like tickles me, makes my little heart pink. Don't know if either of those two are sayings more than that. So these style of episodes are my absolute freaking favorite because there are some that are sneaky, right? Like a lot of people can sniff out some of the scams in the fitness industry. V Shred, that dude over there, Gary Brecka, people are starting to catch on, but some are sneaky and they do it and they get away with it. They even almost get support from some of the more credible people in the industry. And it's like, wait a second, let's uncover these a little bit more. I think the first one we're going to dive into, which we've brought up several times on the podcast in before, but we want to dive a little bit deeper into. This is one that has a lot of people fooled.
Oh, a cult-like following, for sure.
Cult-like. And if you trash talk it, they are at your throats.
Athletic Greens powder. And I think we could...
An FS Pod favorite.
Yes, yes. And a large amount of their popularity, absolutely without fail, comes from Andrew Huberman and other very popular health and fitness podcasts who are sponsored by them. Mm-hmm. I think that's like when people really first started to hear about them, not on TikTok like you would typically see. I mean, Bloom Greens could also fall under this category, but I think we've exhausted talking about Bloom Greens so much. And I think Athletic Greens is one of the more sneaky trends that, because they're very smart about their marketing and not everyone is sponsored by them, like Bloom, they'll reach out to any influencer. Mm. No, Athletic Greens is very smart in who they choose to promote their products.
They've really framed themselves as like a upper echelon. I mean, when I was looking it up for a video with shipping, it's around like $88 or $98 in the US, at least in the US, which is not cheap for a 30-day supply of any supplement. And you're right, they position themselves with very particular, which is, always cracks me up because we've talked trash on them how many times on this podcast. And we've both gotten reached out to how many times
offering to work with them. Yeah.
To work with them. We're like, I don't think you guys know who you're reaching out to if that's what you want to align with. But the Huberman, I looked up the stat. They spent $2.7 million in March, 1 month, March of last year alone, just on podcast sponsorships. $2.7 million. That's not including other marketing campaigns or influencer sponsorships who, I mean, they've done them with like gold medalist Shawn Johnson, the Olympian. They've got big names. So that's not including that. $2.7 million.
That makes me nauseous.
Necessarily like this product is bad because of that or because it's expensive. There are good expensive products, right? But let's dive into like what it is, because I don't know about you. We love Huberman. We do.
For sure.
In love with him, I would say. In love. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to products in this industry, I think it's really important that you judge it for what it is and not who's selling it to you.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, it's not just who's promoting it or who's recommending it. It's who's selling it to you. Mm-hmm. We love him. We love Chris. We love everyone else who promotes him. But again, they're getting paid probably a big hand of that $2.7 million a month to say that. So all we're trying to do, right, is just judge this on what it is. So let's judge it on what it is.
Look at it at face value. Yeah.
Yeah.
First off, it's a greens powder supplement. I think people breeze past the word supplement and don't take it for what it is. It is supplemental to your diet. It is not a replacement for anything. It doesn't mean that it comes first. It is supplemental to things. So if you are not eating your vegetables, this is not a replacement. This is not going to outdo a shitty diet. It's not going to replace vegetables in your diet. Food first, always. And if you're eating your vegetables, which if you're an adult, like, find ways to eat your veggies. I'm sorry. If you don't like them, not an excuse. I cop out. There's many ways you can make vegetables taste good and also sneak them into your food. So first and foremost, just get that out of the way. I feel very strongly about it. But it's not a replacement to anything. So that's what it is. It's a powdered green supplement. It also has, they also have probiotics. So they use a lot of marketing around gut health. They use a lot of marketing catered towards more energy because it has B vitamins. It basically has everything under everything, the sun.
That's how it's marketed. Everything. I mean, I think it might even be marketed the only supplement you'll ever need.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is a line with everything. I mean, they'll fix every problem. I'm fatigued. I'm not sleeping well. I'm bloated. I'm this. Whatever new problem exists in a month or two from now, I guarantee they're going to market for it. They're not going to change their product, but it's going to be marketed for.
Yeah. Yeah. And as a whole, Americans do not get enough fruits and veggies. These supplements are not marketed to people that actually could benefit from them. Those who don't have access to healthier foods, maybe live in low-income communities, maybe are on supplemental nutrition assistance programs, are just not getting as many whole foods in their diet simply because they don't have access to them and they can't afford them. This product is not marketed to them. A lot of health and wellness products, greens powders especially, are marketed towards already healthy individuals who are already eating their vegetables, who are already eating healthy. When you really think about it, that is the craziest thing to me that people don't see, is that already healthy people are marketing this product. If you're eating whole foods majority of the time, you don't need to take a greens powder at all. You don't even need to take a multivitamin. So that's just something to really think about. It's also illogical to take any supplement without evidence of a deficiency or insufficiency. So this kind of goes along with what we've talked about before in the past with multivitamins. It's not productive to just take a small amount of a bunch of different vitamins and minerals if you don't actually need them. First thing you should do before taking any supplement is, first priority would be getting blood work done. If you can't afford that, don't have access to it, at least track your diet for like 2 weeks in, say, a Chronometer or MyFitnessPal, and see which micronutrients, so vitamins and minerals, you may be lacking in. Then introduce them in your diet, try to. Then think about getting a concentrated supplement. So say vitamin D, for example, getting a high concentration of that supplement so you can target that specific insufficiency or deficiency. That is productive. taking a bunch all at once and in smaller amounts, and you don't even know if you need them.
Yeah, just like a sprinkle of a little bit of everything. That's not going to solve any problems. It's not going to fill in any gaps, right? Because that's all a good supplement does, is fill in a gap that exists in your diet. That's all it does. Like when people ask us all the time, like, what, okay, like I get it, I get your supplement take, but what's like a supplement or a couple supplements that everybody should be taking? It's like that the answer to that question doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Right? For you, it might be magnesium, but if I get enough magnesium in my diet, taking more is not going to do anything. And it's so funny to me when you look up, because I don't know about you, I was looking this up last night for this episode. They've kind of hidden the nutrition label a little bit deeper on their site to make it harder to find. It was easier a few months ago when I was looking it up, and I was like, looking, it took me a good 5-10 minutes to figure out where it was, because now they just list what ingredients are inside the product. They don't tell you how much of each is inside.
Yeah.
And on their website, at least on their website, until you like really dig deep to find their nutrition label, which still has a ton of proprietary blends, but at least has some in there. But it's like,
that's the biggest, I would say, since you're bringing it up, the proprietary blends piece of Athletic Greens powder. So their ingredients are, for Athletic Greens powder, all of their ingredients are listed under 3 different proprietary blends. So for those of you who don't know, a proprietary blend allows companies to not tell you how much of each ingredient is used. They only have to list the total amount of the blend as a whole. So you could add in smaller amounts of, say, the more expensive ingredients. You could put filler in there. You just have to list that the ingredient is there, not how much. So a lot of companies are able to buy the cheaper ingredients, save on the more expensive ones, but still use the more expensive ones to sell their product. It's really shady. And that is my biggest red flag with any supplement. If it has proprietary blends, walk away, because you can never know what exactly is in that blend. You can't know.
It's shady, because think about it like this. Like a good helpful analogy, I think, to use people is that cake analogy that I was excited. I told you about it the first time I thought of it. I was like, this is genius. But the analogy to think of it is, if you go on their website, like I was just showing you, they will list proud all of the different ingredients inside of their product. We've got reishi mushroom. We've got all these incredible ingredients, and it looks enticing. Like it's like, oh my God, there's all these superfoods, super supplements all in one thing. That's incredible. But like we talk about a lot in the, whenever we talk about something negative or toxic, it's like the poison's always in the dose. The dose of something will make it either good or not so good for you. And that's what matters, where it's like, oh, this has reishi mushroom. It's like, oh, well, a certain amount of reishi mushroom can provide certain benefits, but less than that isn't really going to do anything. And I think that's why they've more so hidden how much of everything is inside, because who cares? It's got X, Y, and Z in it. That's all you should care about. It's like, no, how much is actually there? And the cake analogy that I was talking about is, I mean, imagine if you're going to bake a cake, because Mariana is a famous chef baker, if y'all didn't know. But if you are going to bake a cake, I think the basic ingredients you're going to need are like flour, sugar, baking soda, salt, eggs, milk, butter, right? Vanilla. You need all of those ingredients, but you don't just need the right ingredients. You need enough of each one to make the full cake. So when you look at a cake, for example, look at just flour. Flour is, I would say, the most important part of a cake. Would you disagree?
Yeah.
It provides the structure. It helps absorb liquids. It gives it that like cakey texture that you kind of need. And you need about 2 cups of flour to bake a full cake. So imagine you go to the store and you buy a cake mix with all the ingredients you need to bake that cake already inside of it. But when you get home and open up the cake mix that said, we have all the ingredients inside, you realize there's only 1 or 2 tablespoons of flour, where you really need 2 cups. Can you still build a cake with 1 to 2 tablespoons? No, you can't, is the answer.
Yeah.
And the same thing happens. It's called the clinically effective dose of supplements. And this is why we love examine.com. It's a free resource that anyone can go look up the clinically effective dose of any supplement. That just means how much of it is needed to make a difference. And I remember I brought up their, for example, their mushroom proprietary blend that they have. One of the, all of them are ridiculous, but I think this is an easy one for an example. They have 5 ingredients inside. And again, like Mariana said, they don't have to tell you how much of each one is inside. The total of the blend is 154 milligrams. right? 154 is a combination of all five of those. So if we just pick out one of them, the reishi mushroom, for example, which has been shown to regulate your blood sugar, improve your immune health, cognition, that's only when you take between 1,500 and 9,000 milligrams per day of just reishi mushroom, you might start to see those benefits, the clinically effective dose. It doesn't have to take some, you don't even have to break out your calculator to understand that even if that entire blend of all five ingredients was just reishi mushroom, you would still have less than a tenth of what you would need to actually make any sort of a difference in your health. And that's what they do in all of their blends. Like, so people are like, oh, but it's good for it. It's not. That's what, it blows my mind about that. Like the proprietary blends, and even honestly, the vitamins and minerals on the other side of their label that they do list how much of is in each ingredient. Like, I think magnesium, they have 26 milligrams of magnesium. So to your point, I think, what was it? About half of Americans don't get enough magnesium in their diets from that deficiency episode that we did quite a bit ago. I think it's around half of Americans. Yeah. So about half of Americans don't get enough magnesium, which is around, I think, 400 milligrams per day. So again, a good supplement helps fill that gap. This supplement does have magnesium, but it has 26 milligrams.
Yeah.
It's not going to fill any real gap. Most supplements have 100 or 200 milligrams to help fill that gap.
Yeah. And the, what's like really frustrating about it to me too, is that there is a lot of research done on vegetables and their impact on overall health. And with a, with, because greens powders are concentrated forms of vegetables, it's very easy to connect them to the benefits of a diet rich in vegetables, such as lower risk for heart disease, lower risk for diabetes, lower risk of all-cause mortality, improved cognitive function, improved energy. But that is research on actual food. The research on actual food and dietary patterns cannot be extrapolated to the benefits of a powder. But that's what these companies like Athletic Greens do. They will pull research, which is good research, but research from diets rich in these vegetables, not people consuming these powders. They are not the same thing. Because what did I say before? Just because you're taking a greens powder isn't going to outdo a shitty diet. It's not going to outdo shitty lifestyle habits. It's going to have, it's a very small effect, little to none. But that is where they can get very deceiving. And they'll use these statistics on diets rich in vegetables. Mm-hmm. They'll use those statistics on their website, but it's not relevant at all because we're not, it's not talking about the powder. It's not even talking about the product. So that's really frustrating. Something I also just want to point out, one of the biggest benefits from eating a diet rich in veggies and getting your greens in is fiber. I think Athletic Greens had like 2 grams, have less than 3 grams of fiber per serving. So you're barely getting any fiber, which is where you get a lot of the health benefits from.
But that's not going to stop them from marketing that it'll give you all those benefits.
Oh, yeah.
Keep that in mind. That's not going to stop. You can market that all you want. That's what kills me. Get you all these gut health and bloating benefits, like from your 2 grams of fiber.
Eat your veggies. And you don't need to waste your money on a greens powder. If you want to spend your money on supplements, find out where you're lacking in your diet. Always try to improve your diet first. But to be productive, find out where you're lacking in your diet and get supplements that you know are targeting that gap. For me, example, I get vitamin D. Vitamin D is actually something Tony and I both recommend to the majority of people. It's harder to get in your diet, so the majority of people can just benefit from taking vitamin D in general. I take vitamin D, I take magnesium, and I take a probiotic. Like, that would change depending on my blood work, depending on my dietary habits during that season. But you want to have
I was going to say, the one you brought up, Chronometer, does a phenomenal job in their free version. They have a paid version, but their free version does an incredible job of giving you a micronutrient breakdown.
Yeah.
Track your food for a week. See where you got these gaps. If you can, move food around to hit it. If it's too challenging, like magnesium, we've talked about that. It's hard to get through your diet alone. There's not a ton of super high magnesium foods that could help you hit your daily goal. And the last piece I'm going to add in this, before we go into number two, because this cracks me up when I was doing my little investigation of AG1, which I went deep into. It always cracks me up, but I don't know if anyone knows this at home. You can look up the public history of every version of someone's website on webarchives.org. So Athletic Greens, this has been a company for over a decade. You can see every past version of their websites, what they've been marketing, what they've been claiming, all these things. And this doesn't incriminate anybody, not at all. But you can look back, I think just a few years ago, they publicly said, and that was advertised, AG1 replaces eating 12 servings of fruits and vegetables, completely replaces the need for that. Until they almost got sued because anyone with, I mean, common sense or just the smallest nutrition background, like they realized that, like what you said, powdered multivitamins aren't the same thing as the complex nutrition properties of eating. So they changed it. And if you notice, what's been trending over the last couple of years? Gut health. That's been hot over the last several years. About 2 or 3 years ago, they added the term gut health and bloating, all this onto their page. After 5 years ago, the term gut health and bloating 10x'd on Google search and Google Trends, 10x'd 1 to 2 years following. What do you know? AG1, they didn't change their ingredients. Their ingredients stayed the exact same. But now they do all these and solve all these problems that they apparently didn't before, or they didn't market before. So is that incriminating? No. But it's just like, look at the values. And it's like, wait a sec. Why does this now fix this problem, but it didn't before, if nothing changed? This is a marketing company. This is not a health company.
Yeah.
Is what we're telling you. Goodness freaking gracious.
Easy What's one. Next?
I love that one. What's next? One that has a soft spot in Tony's heart. One in Tony's heart. Number two on the list. Now, this was going to be an individual product, but we wanted to widen it out because it does cast a large umbrella. And I know I've talked about this in a lot of different episodes, but I don't know if we've ever done like a big focus on this one. But this is essentially anything claiming to reduce your blood sugar spikes, your insulin, track your blood glucose levels, or make that seem important for some reason. Really just anything that makes insulin or blood sugar the root of your health problems if you're not a type 1 or type 2 diabetic. And that's the important part, right? I'm talking about otherwise healthy individuals that do not have type 1, type 2, or are pre-diabetic. Mm-hmm. Big, big difference, because a lot of these technologies, supplements, things like that can actually be pretty helpful to diabetics. So what did this industry see? Oh, people are kind of afraid of the word insulin now. Let's take the products that diabetics are using and let's start offering them to non-diabetics, telling them that it'll give these all these benefits, right? That's what we're talking about. So this is CGMs, or continuous glucose monitors, anti-blood sugar spike supplements. Oh, like Glucose Goddess, who has built her business on telling you that insulin's the devil, is just so happened to come out with her own supplement, which cracks me up. I was going to put this together for this episode. I was just looking through her site, looking through what the supplement is, because it's in pre-sale now. It's not being sold yet, but you can pre-order.
Of course.
And all of everything about her is like backed by research and backed by science. And she will cite I'm doing air quotes right now if you are just listening, the research on her website, but you can never actually find a link to the actual papers. It's all graphs of blood sugar and blood glucose monitors that we don't know are real. You could have made them in Canva. It's like, this is if you eat sushi with.
It's probably her doing it.
Like, and then if you eat sushi with my supplement, it's a lower blood glucose, but all this stuff. Ridiculous. But I didn't go too deep into that. Or really, I mean, this is any dieting method to reduce insulin or blood sugar, like anything selling you on that. And I think if we start with CGMs or continuous glucose monitors, it kind of maps out the reason why all of this starts to fall apart. Yeah. Because CGMs, these are sick pieces of technology, right? I've got one. If I wasn't wearing a hoodie, you could see it right now.
Tony is type 1 diabetic, for those of you who don't know. Your rage should be so much higher about this topic than it is. I feel like I have more rage than you, and Trust me,
when I see it, I do. Because I've been a type 1 diabetic since I was 19 years old. And type 1, we're going to go into a little bit more detail later. Type 1 is the genetic type, right? Yeah. Nothing really... I would have gotten type 1 diabetes if I was the healthiest or least healthiest person on the planet. Type 2, it does have a genetic component, but it is more based on your lifestyle and diet. Mm-hmm. But I've been type 1 since I was 19 years old, insulin dependent. So what these CGMs are, I mean, again, dope and actually life-saving for some people. They just measure your blood sugar in real time. Every 5 minutes, it's sending signals over. Okay. Blood sugar, for those wondering, this is just the amount of sugar called glucose in your blood circulating at all time. For normal people, wants to be kept around like 90 to 110, 120. Fasted, just normal people chilling at that level. That's a good level. And this glucose, this is your body's main source of energy. Okay. These things are, I say they're like indistinguishable from magic. If you gave an iPhone 12 and a little CGM to a Victorian child, they'd be burned at the stake. These things are freaking cool. They're dope. But they work by sticking this little hair-like sensor just under your skin that interacts with the sugar in your interstitial fluid. It's like a freaky kind of sugar. And it creates this little electric current. And then you can measure how much of that current there is, and it can tell you how much sugar is present. Now, the question comes up, why is it important to know your blood sugar at all times of the day, 24/7? If you're diabetic, the way your body turns food into energy changes. Normally, when you eat, your body breaks down food, especially carbs, into a sugar called glucose. And that goes into your bloodstream to then be taken to the cells all around your body to be used as energy. But to use it for energy, to get inside those cells, your body needs a hormone called insulin, okay, to move that sugar out of your bloodstream into the cells. Think of it like your cells having a little lock and insulin's the key that unlocks it. Okay, when you're diabetic, either one, your body doesn't produce insulin, which is type one, right? Your pancreas just offs itself, no longer produces insulin, or your body doesn't use it well, which is mostly type two diabetes, meaning insulin gets released, but your cells aren't very receptive. It's like clogging up the locks a little bit. Either way, the sugar just stays in your blood and has nowhere to go. So your blood sugar numbers rise, and that's where things get a little scary. So this is why most diabetics have to give themselves a shot of insulin every time they eat, at least an insulin-dependent one. Without getting too complicated, why you would need to know where your blood sugar is if you're in this situation is to know how much medication to give yourself or how much insulin. For example, I need to know before I give myself a shot if I'm going to eat, I don't know, a Chipotle burrito. I need to know where my blood sugar is to know how much insulin I should give myself. If my blood sugar is chilling at like 100, I would give myself a different amount of insulin if my blood sugar was up at like 190, which is not uncommon for diabetics, right? So it's very important for me to know where I am so I know how much medication to give myself. Because if I give myself too much, I could pass out, or if I take too little, I could go to the hospital. Kind of problematic. So the question comes up and it's like, okay, well, if you're not diabetic, why do you need to know what your blood sugar is at all time? Because if you see, what are your favorite, what's his name? Rav, we got Blood Sugar King.
Rav.
Glucose Goddess.
He has the feel-good system.
The feel-good system.
Which is literally an MLM.
That does crack me up when you just, he doesn't even try to hide it. It's like just blatantly front page. But they are non-diabetic people. Glucose Goddess, Blood Sugar King, Rav. There's probably a lot of little minions of them out there.
There's also that guy that literally just his whole page is, this is what happens to my blood sugar when I eat a banana versus a pizza.
Like, that might be Blood Sugar King, because that's who I'm like. He's
No, it's not Blood Sugar King. I know who he does that too.
But similar.
Yeah.
Which, when it's interesting, if you like, if Mariana right now or you listening to this, put one of these on your body, you would notice when you eat a meal, especially when high in carbs, your blood sugar is going to go up. Right? As you digest the food, it gets put into your bloodstream, and then it's going to come back down, right? So it has, they call it a spike, right? It comes up, it's like a little hill, and comes back down to normal. Okay, that's what happens. I want to call them like boobs. I don't know what you call these guys. People like Rav, the Blood Sugar King, Glucose Goddess, they will show you this graph, and they'll say, this is what happened after I ate pizza or sushi or a bowl of fruit or whatever. And they'll be on their iPads and they have all this text. So you're like, oh, this must be legit. And they'll circle the big spike. And they're like, this is bad. Insulin causes fat gain and disease, all this stuff. Yeah. And you believe them because like it's expensive and it sounds legitimate. But there's three big problems I want to highlight here with this. Aside from the fact that, like you mentioned, like all three of these people are also selling you the magic solution to this problem in their bio.
Yeah.
That's a little bit of a problem. But this is aside from that. So first,
I don't know if you're going to say this, but first of all, they're showing a normal response in your body. These people aren't diabetics, like your blood sugar should be spiking. That's what happens when you eat a lot of sugar. They're proving that their body is functioning properly.
Exactly. So. That was going to be one of the three points I'm making here. No, like if you're normal, if you don't have diabetes and you ate food, especially when high in carbs and your blood sugar went up, and then came back down to normal, you should be thrilled. Mm-hmm. Your body is working exactly how it should be, how you want it to be. That is the best possible case scenario. That's not a bad thing. That's a good thing. If it stayed elevated and didn't come back down to normal, that's when things would become a problem. Now, another problem is that people don't realize this. They like to paint sugar, carbs as the enemy. There are so many things that influence your blood sugar levels that are not carbs or sugar. And people do not realize this. People do not realize this. I made a fancy little list, and there's probably 20, 30 more on this. So in your diet, things like just protein, just fats, simple things like being dehydrated, drinking caffeine, all of these things can influence and spike blood sugar, even if you have zero carbs, zero sugar, nothing. From a biological standpoint, a bad night's sleep, being stressed or anxious, being sick or on your period, all of these things can spike your blood sugar without you touching a piece of food. Exercise. Oh, what? Lifting heavy weights, especially high forms of intensity of weight training or cardio, high intensity forms, will spike your blood sugar. Okay. Even simply just changing the time of day that you exercise can influence your blood sugar. Even pieces of your environment, like being in very cold temperatures for extended periods of time. People have never heard of that before. Yeah. Having a sunburn, being in a humid environment. All of these things influence how your body and blood sugar responds. So when these people are telling you to not eat a certain food because of the way it affected their blood sugar, like the blood sugar king, who specifically, I cannot make this up, tells you to not eat red apples, only the green ones, because the red one spiked his blood sugar for an extra 20 minutes. I'm not making this up. Realize that that food is literally only one of about 20 plus other factors that will determine how his blood sugar responds. I cannot make this stuff up. The second piece of this is that these people are just simplifying the health of a food down to one metric. Okay. There's like people who are anti-insulin, all this, they're simplifying the health of a food or how healthy something is on the fact of whether or not it spikes your blood sugar. Okay. Blood sugar king. Can't eat grapes. Do not let him catch you eating grapes. Don't eat the red apples, only the green apples. So if you use this as a compass, eating a banana and some fresh raspberries, which have prebiotic fiber, magnesium, potassium, vitamins A, B, C, K, phenomenal health foods, would be considered less healthy than, let's say, a bowl of Kentucky Fried Chicken, because the banana and berries would spike your blood sugar more. So Stay away from those. But no, go to KFC, get a family bucket, Go drive your heart wild. All of this in a sense of just because it's like your body should be reacting in these ways. It blows my mind. And I think when people don't realize this, insulin plays a lot of important roles. It plays a lot of important roles in the body, like helping build muscle by enhancing muscle protein synthesis. It shuttles nutrients into your muscles and tissue, helping you recover. It suppresses appetite hormones like ghrelin. Okay, suppresses ghrelin. It's a good thing in moderation, like everything, the poisons in the dose. It's not a bad thing in moderation. Okay, your health is a lot more complex than one enemy. And the thing that cracks me up about CGMs in particular, not even talking about supplements and all this stuff, they cost about $400 a month.
You don't $400 even, what the
bucks
fuck?
A month and require a needle in your arm 24/7. And if you're healthy, you're not diabetic, and you're like, oh, but I'm worried about insulin resistance in my future, maybe becoming pre-diabetic, you could get more valuable information out of a fasted blood test once a year, measuring your HbA1c, fasted insulin, fasted glucose, which we even have with Merrick, our blood work that we designed with them, tests for all that. That can tell you so much more valuable information than wearing a needle in your arm 24/7, spending $400 a month that you could look at this. It's like the best way I could put it is it's like you're spending a ton of money on a deep sea submarine with all the cool tech to go visit the Titanic to use in your backyard swimming pool. You don't need it. Sure, it's cool. It's overkill. It'll have no impact on your actual health. And I think the last piece on the diet and supplement piece of like wanting to avoid blood sugar spikes, high blood sugar over time, I'm not saying this is not true, can damage endothelial tissue, right? Which is just a layer of cells lining your blood vessels over time. That is true. This can lead to problems like heart disease, nerve damage, eye damage, even Alzheimer's. Those are not good things. But when we say that high blood sugar can do those things, this is talking about diabetics and especially ones who do not manage it well, with decades of blood sugars in the 200s, the 300s, 24/7, 200-300s, 24/7 can damage that over decades. Hmm. Not your normal blood sugar, which if you notice, any of these people who are circling the spikes might jump from like 100 to like 125 or 135 and then come right back down to normal. Your body is made to handle that. That is not a bad thing. That's what cracks me up. People are like, oh, high blood sugar does this. Yeah, like actual high blood sugar, mm-hmm. not what you get from eating a meal out. Or if it goes, oh my God, 160, I'm going to die. Last night, my blood sugar was like 230. It happens. It happens. There's my, there. Did that passion come out a little bit?
Yeah, it did. It's all, it also become, there's a lot of people that it's just so fucking disordered of like people becoming obsessed with having to monitor every little thing that has to do with their health when they don't have to and become obsessed with it and rules their lives. It just can be such an unhealthy behavior as well.
Because we love data. Like we don't shut up about it. The more data, usually the better. But there's such a thing as overkill.
If it serves a purpose, right?
Yeah. Like, measuring this will tell you nothing. Like measuring your weight daily can be very helpful if you're trying to figure out where a calorie deficit is for you. Mm-hmm. Tracking your blood sugar, what are you realistically going to get from that? It's not going to tell you the health of a food. It's not going to tell you what foods you should eat or avoid. None of that. What are you actually going to get out of it? Nothing. Mm-hmm. Period. T.
Period.
Don't fall for it. Oh my goodness gracious. I didn't realize what was next on the list though. This one's going to make some people mad. I made a post on this and people got more pissed about this one than anything else.
Yeah. So people don't like to be challenged anymore. And it's frustrating. Challenged to think a little bit. So this is organic foods. One of the biggest scams in nutrition, fitness, health, what marketing industry you could think of is the organic food label. So the U.S. organic food market grew from less than $8 billion in sales in 2000 to over $50 billion in 2021. So this was just metrics from the more recent data. I don't even have to 2024. There is so much money in organic food just by slapping on that label. So that's the first thing. I just want to highlight that. It's a money grab. That's what it is. It's a cash grab, the organic food industry. When it started, it was when the Clinton administration was around, and his name was Dan Glickman, and he oversaw the organics label designation. And he said, and I quote, "It is not a statement about food safety, nor is organic a value judgment about nutrition or quality of food."
Can you say that again? I want you to say that again for the people listening. This is the person who is in charge of making organic a thing. Organic labeling a thing. The person who created it said what?
"It is not a statement about food safety, nor is organic a value judgment about nutrition or quality." That was never the intention. Our society,
I almost want to make you say it again. That's ridiculous.
Did that. Yeah. So through very clever and very misleading marketing, this health halo effect has developed around organic food. What that is this health halo effect. It's an act of overestimating the healthfulness of an item based off of a single claim, such as organic, all natural, free range, things like that. And
non-GMO.
Yeah. And that is when it started to blow up. Because it's organic, it's better for you. It's healthier for you. Not organic means bad. And this industry boomed. It took over. There's so much money in now attaching this label, and it is just deceiving people left and fucking. And why do I say that? So first you have to understand, like, what is the main difference between organic and conventional food? So there's this impression that organic food is grown without chemicals. That's the biggest thing you'll see people say all the time. You know, you have to buy organic to avoid the chemicals, the pesticides, they're toxic. This is wrong. All farmers, both organic and conventional farmers, use both chemical and non-chemical containment methods. Organic regulations were designed to promote the use of natural chemicals over synthetic ones. However, over 100 fertilizers and inputs, so this could be pesticides, insecticides, fungicides, are authorized by organic farming regulations in the US and Europe, and non-synthetic pesticides, as well as synthetic pesticides, are permitted in organic farming. That's the biggest thing, is they're trying to make this distinguishment between the type of pesticide or chemical used. However, it's actually not true. Synthetic pesticides and chemicals are permitted in organic farming. That's the craziest thing to me.
And that's the number one argument that people will clap at me when I say that, is like, are you seriously putting pesticides in your body by eating non-organic? And I'm like, this person doesn't even know what organic means.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really just the designation of natural chemicals versus synthetic ones. It doesn't mean that there's no chemicals or no pesticides used. It's the type. And you go a step further, and now it's like, well, actually, if you read between the lines, farmers just have to get approval to use these not natural or synthetic chemicals and pesticides. Organic farmers have gotten approval from the USDA to use dozens of synthetic chemicals. So they're still used, and non-synthetic pesticides, or these natural pesticides, are actually less effective than synthetic pesticides, therefore are used at much higher quantities. So it's
That's
still a pesticide.
You're
still getting these chemicals. It's just a type of chemical. And there is so much more sprayed on organic crops. So what would we do without pesticides? We wouldn't have food. This allows us to have a lot of food to feed a lot of people, because we can prevent these crops from dying out, from getting eaten by these bugs. We can make a lot of them. We can transport them. And they're so heavily regulated, which is going to be my next point. Get this in your head, that organic does not mean chemical-free or pesticide-free. Organic still uses pesticides and chemicals. The biggest scam. And then you get this, going into this argument that organic foods are safer to eat. All pesticides, synthetic or not, must meet identical safety standards. So when used appropriately, approved chemicals, synthetic or natural, do not pose any meaningful health risks. Food scientists at the University of California, Davis, concluded that the marginal benefits of reducing human exposure to pesticides in the diet through increased consumption of organic produce appears to be insignificant. And this was looking at each year. So this is at UC Davis, but each year a team pulled from different universities, different scientists and researchers are hand selected to review all of the biggest farms in the U.S. and test their chemicals and pesticides, organic and non-organic, for their safety measures. And this was just a metric that they pulled. And year after year, there is no difference between the safety of organic versus non-organic. And the nutritional quality of organic food, for some reason, people will say like organic is better for you, which organic has nothing to do with nutrition. One of the most comprehensive meta-analyses to date of existing studies comparing organic and conventional foods concluded that there is no strong evidence that organic foods are more nutritious or carry fewer health risks than conventional alternatives. And that, again, year over year, that doesn't change.
I was going to say, like, this is not just like, oh, well, it makes sense in like theory of how it might want to be healthy. That's why we do these tests, is because if it actually was more nutritious, healthier, safer, we would want to know, right? We would want to know. We would want this industry to boom. So that's why they do these tests. But like you're saying, it's like over and over and over again. It's like, oh, we found nothing. We looked hard at it. We looked deep. We looked all around it. We didn't find anything.
Yeah. And
like, it's not just speculation.
Yeah. The World Health Organization actually establishes safe intake levels of individual pesticide inputs, where they're called acceptable daily intakes, are set at levels for which exposure would have no carcinogenic effect on human health. Because that's another thing, is that pesticides cause cancer. These pesticide residues
give you cancer.
The food governing bodies in the U.S., so the U.S., Europe has this as well, they have these maximum residue limits. And these are enforced by these governing bodies to ensure that the consumer's food has residue levels of these pesticides so far below these safety limits. You get trace amounts. You're not even reaching the limit at which you might have some sort of health risk from ingesting this pesticide. There is a study published in the Journal of Toxicology that investigated the 10 most frequently identified pesticide residues across 12 commodity crops. In all, pesticide exposure estimates were found to be well below the chronic reference dose, so that like highest dose to cause disease. And 75% of these commodities measured below 0.01% of these limits. So this means that residue levels were 1 million times lower than the threshold for which they might impose negative health effects. Over 1 million times lower.
Which people realize, like, that is virtually zero. That is virtually nothing.
Yeah.
It's just like that little footnote had to be like, this is virtually nothing. That blows my mind. Less than a millionth of a percent.
Yeah.
From the point where it might start to cause issues. That blows my mind.
Yeah. It's really infuriating to me.
And I think why we like say this is wasting money. I mean, this is organic food is expensive. I remember we looked it up on Consumer Reports. It's on average, the organic version of foods are about 47% more expensive than their non-organic parts, right? This was on, and this was a while ago. I would not be shocked after inflation. This is before the last like 5 or so years. I wouldn't be shocked if that was even more expensive.
Yeah.
If you're a family of four, or even just you or I, that is thousands of dollars a year that you are spending on something that is in no way, shape, or form better for you or safer for you than the conventional. You might like the taste of something. If you, the personal preference, cool, go for it. And it's not like, oh, it's a little bit healthy. It's not a little bit healthy. It's not.
No.
It's the same damn thing.
And they're still using pesticides and chemicals. I think where this got so out of hand too is with the stupid fucking Dirty Dozen list. And people are like, oh, well, the Dirty Dozen, it's unsafe. Yep. So the Dirty Dozen was created by the Environmental Working Group. And it is one of the biggest scams you could possibly think of. So what they do, what this environmental working group does, is they manipulate this data that I was just telling you about, the safety of pesticides and their safety levels. And what they do is they do zero testing on pesticide concentration. They don't take any of the concentration into account. They ignore that data that is provided by the World Health Organization, the EPA, which is the Environmental Protection Agency. They don't take into account the amount of each individual pesticide. They base this Dirty Dozen ranking solely on the number of different pesticide types added to fruits and veggies. So they don't rank them based on pesticide concentration levels, which the concentration, again, dose makes the poison. The concentration determines the health and the safety of this pesticide or this food. They don't take that into account. They just say, well, bananas have 10 different types of pesticides and strawberries only have 5 different types of pesticides. So bananas are worse. They fail to account for the fact that also organic foods contain pesticides. So they don't even, they just ignore that fact.
They're like, no, we're not going to look over there. No, we're not looking over there.
Because organic does not mean pesticide free. I hate to break it to everyone. Organic foods have pesticides. This whole Dirty Dozen list is complete and utter bullshit. They are not taking dosage into account. They're just like, yeah, this food has more different types, so it's worse for you. Even though it could have a much lower concentration than, say, a different food with only one type of pesticide. But it's still worse because they're not taking concentration into account.
That's always what cracks me up, because people, when they disagree, if I say something about that, how organic labeling is one of the biggest scams over the last few decades, they'll be like, I totally agree with you, except for the Dirty Dozen. They always say that, the Dirty Dozen, except for the Dirty Dozen, which kills me. It's that halo effect. It just has been instilled in people's minds since the day where they were born.
Over time.
It's more expensive. Yeah. This is the healthier version of a food. Yeah. As soon as you start to look below that first layer of like, oh, why is it healthier? You're like, oh, wait, there's nothing here. Nothing, not a little bit. Mm-hmm. That blows my mind. And especially when people, the comments I get are on GMOs, on all this, which the GMO conversation cracks me up too. Because when I looked up, because I was not as familiar with GMOs to partake in like a disagreement with somebody. Mm-hmm. I knew my stance, but I didn't understand their stance well enough to partake in a disagreement. There's only, I don't think people realize this. There are 11 GMO crops that exist. 11. That's it, right? Soybeans, corn, canola, cotton, alfalfa, sugar beets, a few more. Summer straws, apples, potatoes, stuff like that. Only 11. And this cracks me up because you'll see at the grocery store, you'll get like you'll see some milk or something like that that says like GMO free. And people don't realize, they're like, oh, I would choose that one. It's that halo effect. Not realizing that GMO milk doesn't exist.
No. So
when it says non-GMO milk, they're like, oh, this must be better. It's like, no, GMO milk doesn't exist. It's not a real thing. So they just added that because, again, it gets people to buy. And I promise you that one was a dollar or two more than the one without GMOs on the freaking label. Mm-hmm. It cracks me up. It cracks me. And GMOs too, like they're not a bad thing.
Oh, a good GMO apple, a big, fat, gigantic, red, juicy apple. I'm like, ooh, this has so many GMOs. I'm going to eat it and it's going to taste so
like it allows the food to grow bigger, hold more nutrients. Like all, it's crazy because people, just, you're putting all that manufactured stuff in your body. It's like, there's more vitamins, more minerals. I can actually leave it in my house for a couple of days without it rotting in the first 12 hours after getting home from the grocery store. They're not like negative for your health.
People are so fucking hypocritical. It's like, we don't live in a world where everyone's growing their own crops anymore. This had to happen. This had to happen so we could feed people.
It blows my mind. It absolutely, that the organic food labeling, I think would be, if I had to rank on our list of top 10, I would say that has to be the number one.
Yeah.
The number one. Cause like, Athletic Greens.
If you're really worried about it, like buy fruits and vegetables in season. That's what I always try to do. Because in season crops, it doesn't matter if they're organic or not organic. Naturally, they're going to have less pesticide residues. Not that you should need to worry about them at all. But I'm just saying, if you are the type of person that maybe you have a little bit of a fear, but you still want to save money, like, okay, transition, get over your fear by buying in season conventional crops or conventional produce first. I do that anyway because in season is typically cheaper and it just,
I feel like they just taste better.
Taste better when it's in season.
When I get like raspberries, blackberries in season, they just taste better.
Yeah. Honest. Yeah.
But I'd still get them the rest of the year.
Oh my God. Like blueberries in the winter, it's going to be like for me, and I'm on the East Coast, a pint of blueberries in the winter is going to be like $7.99 versus in the summer, it's going to be like $3.99.
This list is heating up.
Okay. Sorry. It's next one.
Cooking. Let's keep it going. No, now I'm excited. Now I'm freaking pumped because this is big. Okay. Top three on the list. Oh, I like these. Number four on our list today of five. We got two left here. Number four is another one that has been stricken by the Huberman effect. Along with some of the most influential and credible podcasters in the world, Chris Williamson, Andrew Huberman, I believe Tim Ferriss, but don't quote me on that one. A lot of them. This is, and I didn't know how to say it for the longest time, Element, L-M-N-T, Element, electrolyte supplements. And I almost said electrolyte supplements overall, but Element is by a mile the biggest I see scammy, ripping you off product.
I'm big team Liquid IV over here.
Yeah, there's several that are like Gatorlyte. We'll go over a few that are actually like decent. I'll explain why here in a second too, because electrolytes are very important in your body. Very important. You would die without them. Okay. I'm not saying electrolytes are bad. I'm saying Element, the electrolyte supplement, is garbage. Okay. Yeah. Electrolytes, you would die without them. Okay. They play a necessary function in proper hydration, muscle and brain function, just about every other function in your body, since they're used in every single cell that we have. Okay. Electrolytes are important. And there's several of them, right? Countless of things that you could technically defy as an electrolyte, but the primary ones that we use in our body are sodium, salt is what that is, potassium, magnesium, calcium, phosphate, chloride, and bicarbonate. Those are the primary ones that our body needs to function. Especially if you're somewhat active, these might be more helpful to you. I'm not arguing any of that, okay? The point is that you shouldn't almost even be allowed to call Element an electrolyte supplement. Look at what's inside. It's salt. It's salt. It's table salt. Okay. That's what Element is. Okay. It's table salt. A good supplement, what do we talk about? Has one job: to fill a gap that exists in your diet or from what you don't get from food alone. So a good electrolyte supplement, which there are several, would help you fill those gaps. Okay, would help you fill those gaps. But when you look at the primary electrolytes in our diets and which ones a supplement might help with, and we lay these out, it's like, okay, what electrolytes do most of us consume enough of, not get enough of on average? We tend to get close to double the recommended intake for sodium already, and not even close to enough of almost all the others. Okay. For example, 98% of Americans don't hit the RDA for potassium, a massively important electrolyte in controlling our blood pressure, which is one of the biggest issues in our country when it comes to health and heart disease. 98% of Americans don't hit their RDA.
I remember one time when my brother fainted at our grandpa's wake.
Oh, you told me that.
And we went to the hospital and it was because of a potassium deficiency, literal deficiency. Oh my God, sorry.
It's ridiculous.
I think about that 98. Every time. It cracks me up.
I forgot you told, that was, the circumstance was funny, just how awkward that situation would have been. 98% of people don't get enough potassium. So, maybe a good supplement might have some of that in there. More than half of people in the world don't get enough calcium or magnesium either. Pretty freaking important, okay? Look at what's inside Element. There's 1,000 milligrams of salt, 1,000. And then a literal sprinkle. A sprinkle of potassium and magnesium. I say sprinkle, it's a, just for the little razzle dazzle. Let's throw it in there. I'm talking less than 4% of the potassium we would need and less than 15% of the magnesium we need. If you look at that by volume, over 80% of the entire supplement is just table salt. It's table salt. Okay. And I get it. I know these are the people that argue against it. We do lose salt when we sweat. Okay. We do. And I agree with their marketing. Okay. It's very important to replenish that, especially if you're working out a long time. No one's arguing that. It's important to replenish the salt you lose when you sweat. But they make it seem like this supplement is like the magic, like, oh, you need this to replenish it. You can't do that without. But if you look at the NIFS, okay, they released their annual paper based on the actual research, human research, with this statement that says typically water and a balanced snack are enough to replenish electrolytes after most exercise sessions. Water and a balanced snack. Okay. You could literally achieve any benefits of what Element is by putting an extra pinch of salt on your food.
Pinch or of salt. In your water.
Or in your water, which even, I'm like, that's even gross to me. You don't even have to do that. Put a pinch of salt on your food. And honestly, you don't even need that most of the time. You don't even need that. You would be typically fine. And here's the crazy part is when you look at a few different things. Like when you look at how electrolytes would actually help during exercise and things like this, all of the benefits that may come from electrolytes are when you take them post-exercise, not during. When you take them during, the benefits don't occur until after you're done working out, not while during it. And here's the funniest part to me about Element is that one of their main marketing points, you can see this all over the front page of their website, is how they're zero sugar, 0 grams of sugar, zero carbs. They're keto friendly. Keep in mind, this is a hydration supplement. It's really supposed to be good with one thing, even though their marketing is like it helps cognition and memory and all this stuff, which it doesn't. But their main, it's a hydration supplement. Sugar or glucose is one of the most important factors in rapid hydration. One of the most important things. This is what kills me. Not just hydration, but performance, strength, endurance. Glucose is what is going to help your body perform better. That is one of Element's main marketing pitches. We don't have any of that. They are literally on a billboard marketing. We are worse at doing our only job, not better, because of this thing. That's what it kills me with this. And keep in mind, there are zero studies, showing that just an electrolyte supplement will improve performance in any type of workout. The only ones that show benefit, because this has been tested, the only one that has shown benefit is when they're paired with glucose or sugar, like with Gatorade. This is why athletes drink Gatorade on the sideline, not Element packets.
It's why endurance athletes, runners have like goos and it's literally called goo. It's just concentrated sugar, or will take like those little goos on their run with them because you lose a lot of glucose in your sweat and you need that quick energy. You need to replenish it.
Yeah. And that's what boosts your performance. That's what makes you stronger, builds your endurance up. It's just, which cracks me up. All this is this company is like, oh, they recognize people are afraid of sugar and afraid of carbs. So we're going to market that we don't have any of that. We don't really care about the quality of our product or if it's good at doing its only job. We just care if people buy it because we're selling table salt for $45 for a 30. That's what it is. $45 for a 30-day supply of table salt. It's not a good, it's not good at hydrating. It's not good at any of this.
Don't take it. If you're hungover, it's not going to do jack shit. I mean, you can't like get rid of a hangover, but one of the biggest reasons why you feel the effect of, and not like they're not marketed for hangovers, but people do.
I was going to say that might be like the only legitimate thing where it's like, oh, I'm going to puke if I eat food.
Yeah.
Maybe some of that would like, help a little bit. That's it.
But it's not, that's never, I would never recommend Element for a hangover because one, it has, it doesn't have that sugar, and that sugar is what's going to make you feel better along with the rehydration, but also that sugar piece is going to make you feel better. And you want to make sure you have enough of these electrolytes, which Element is not doing a great job in that because you are depleted of them because.
Yeah. And this is all of them, not just salt, which is all people care about focusing on. That's what cracks me. This is missing more than half of the primary electrolytes. Like some of my favorites, like Gatorlyte. Gatorade made a specific electrolyte supplement. Gatorlyte. Body Armor IV does a good one. Gorilla has an actual good one. And these have a variety of actual legitimate doses of the majority of these primary electrolytes. Pedialyte tastes like crap, but it's better than
it's freaking good.
Well, I remember it because I bought
Element. No, it doesn't taste good, but it works.
I bought Element for a social media post I was going to make explaining all of this, what I just explained to this podcast. And I got it and I was like, let me taste this out a little bit. I'm like, oh my God, this is before I knew what was inside of anything. I was like, oh my God, this tastes like I'm drinking ocean water. This tastes like ocean water. And I look at it, I'm like, oh, it's because it's almost entirely salt. That cracked me up.
Body Armor is good. I like Body Armor, right?
Oh, I love Body Armor, and they have a specific electrolyte. Body Armor in general has a good electrolyte, like insane.
Yeah.
Some of the best potassium I've ever seen in a drink or anything. But they made a specific like electrolyte drink called Body Armor IV, which you can even buy in packets and stuff like that.
If you're trying to get a fuck ton of potassium, watermelon water is really, really good. Ooh. It is so high in potassium. You definitely have to add some salt to it because it doesn't have, but
yeah. Which potassium, you know, we're big fans of that. We did that on the top five vitamin and mineral deficiency episode. Potassium's huge. Mm-hmm. And that's one of those. But again, you're going to say Huberman's wrong. In this case, yes, I love him to death. Again, judge the product based on what it is, not who is
that guy makes a bag on his sponsors. Like you got to think about that. He is the top health and fitness podcast in the US.
Which, and I'm not even honestly blaming him. He's got enough.
He's deserving
on his
of that
plate.
Spot. He is so deserving of that spot. But
like, he's
just...
a professor. He's manages the biggest podcast in the world. He's got too much going on. And this is where I'm like, I can't judge him because if AG1, which is essentially a low quality powdered multivitamin, it's not going to kill anybody.
No.
It's not bad for anybody. It's a complete ripoff, but it's not going to harm anybody.
Yeah.
If I just didn't have time to think about it, if my background's not in nutrition, like his isn't, just came to me and said, hey, we'll pay you probably honestly $10+ million a month if you just shout us out at the beginning of each episode. It's a multivitamin. That's not too hard to turn your head to and be like, okay, cool. They're expensive. Health halo effect. It affects everybody. But same thing with Element, with all these podcasters taking it now. They took the same playbook.
Last one
for the day. Hit us up. This one actually I was not aware of until you brought it to my attention previously. What is
right.
it? Round us off.
These are food sensitivity tests. I have fallen victim to it. I have wasted my money on it. I feel the pain if you've ever taken one and it has ruined your life because you're like, shit, I can't eat anything. I feel you. I was there once. I fell victim to it. All right. Food sensitivity tests. First, I just want to talk about like what these are actually testing and what they aren't. So there is a difference between a food allergy, an intolerance, and a sensitivity. So a food allergy happens when the immune system reacts to a substance, which is usually a protein in a food or a food group. And that reaction will give you that either like hives or people's throat will close up. They'll have that allergic reaction. A food intolerance is not an immune system reaction. they relate to trouble digesting foods. So food intolerances occur due to the lack of an enzyme needed to digest certain foods, or sometimes as a reaction to different additives or naturally occurring compounds in foods, but that's less common. So individuals with food intolerances may be able to eat smaller amounts of bothersome foods, but when they have too much, their body will react to it. So think lactose intolerance. There's a scale there.
That's probably the most common one, right? Is with lactose intolerance.
And some people can eat some cheese and some can't have any. But you take lactase, which is the enzyme, lactate, which contains lactase, the enzyme required to digest lactose, and you're fine. You're good to go. That's not the case with an allergy. You can't take something that's going to make you not allergic. Yeah. Then you go into food sensitivity. And food sensitivity has no standard medical definition. It can be used to mean absolutely anything. Sometimes this term is used instead of food intolerance, such as like a sulfite sensitivity or a gluten sensitivity. Other times it's used as a catchphrase that may include both food allergies and intolerances. People will use it to be grabby and say like, oh, like I'm sensitive to this food. I removed it and everything improved. I'm totally fine now. The evidence is completely lacking to support the use of any sort of food sensitivity tests in diagnosing adverse reaction to food. And this is mainly because food sensitivity is not recognized in the medical community, in the clinical community. There's no real definition for it. It's almost like a lay term that can be used to mean anything to describe a bunch of different GI symptoms.
I don't like things like that.
Yeah. So these tests cost to detect a sensitivity, right? Okay. Cost hundreds of dollars for people to tell you what you're already eating. So let me explain that. So what people think they're doing when they get a food sensitivity test is they're going to take it. Typically, it's like a finger prick or stool. There's different ways you could do it. But that's the most common one, is a finger prick. And people think they're doing that. They'll send it out and it's going to tell them all these foods they're sensitive to. And if they eliminate them, that's going to improve their gut health or certain aspects of their health. It's really mainly targeted toward digestion and gut health and bloating. Okay. But like I said, going back to what I said, it's telling you what you're already eating. So in the case of food allergies, a skin prick and a blood test will measure a protein called IgE. And that's how we diagnose this allergy. The presence of IgE antibodies generally indicate an immune system response. Food sensitivity tests look for the presence of IgG antibodies and determine the sensitivity based off of high levels of IgG. Not IgE. So I just want to make that clear. It's not testing for any sort of allergy or intolerance.
Okay.
And these IgG antibodies have not been shown to be reliable in identifying either a sensitivity or an allergy or an intolerance. And this is because IgG antibodies rise in the blood due to frequent consumption of those foods or recent exposure to that food. So they're not specific to a person's sensitivity, although past or frequent exposure to that food can cause levels to be high. So the foods you eat a lot of, you will see IgG levels rise. It's not a coincidence.
Wait.
Yeah.
So so I'm just getting this straight. So no matter what I might be allergic to, anything like that, let's just say I eat a banana every day and I love bananas.
Mm-hmm.
If I take one of these tests, it's going to show that I have a high IgG antibody for bananas, probably because I eat a lot of them.
Yes.
Where if I just didn't, nothing else changes about me, like genetically, my genetic makeup, nothing else changes, but I stopped eating bananas and then I wait a while, those antibodies would be low because I just, they aren't present in my body because I just don't eat them.
Because you don't eat them.
Not on what or not, like how my body responds. They're just not there because I didn't just eat them.
Yeah.
So you're saying the only reason these would really be high is because you just ate something.
Yeah. Because you either eat it a lot, or say maybe you don't eat this food a lot, but you just so happen to have it for breakfast that morning. You were just recently exposed to it. Then those IgG levels are going to rise.
So are these tests pretty much just telling people what's causing your problems is what makes up your diet?
Yeah.
Everyone here's like, oh, I took this food sensitivity test and I found out that everything I was eating, I was sensitive to.
Yeah. It's not a coincidence that people take these tests and find they are sensitive to foods they eat all the time, the most frequently, their favorite foods. I remember for me, I don't know why I got told so many different foods. Obviously, that's what it does. It doesn't just say one food. It's multiple of them. And they're the ones that are most prevalent in your diet. I remember mangoes really sticking out to me and I was pissed because it was the summer and I love mangoes and I would have so much mango in the summer. And I was so mad that I'm sensitive to mango, but it's just because I eat mango all the time. It is telling you what you all are tolerant to, essentially, like what your body is used to, what you're tolerant to. And then there is this aspect I just want to explain real quickly called cross-reactivity. So you can have results that say you are sensitive to foods you never eat. And this is because the protein structure in some foods is similar to foods you do eat. That's known as cross-reactivity. So this test might recognize, say, you do eat a lot of bananas. There's certain proteins in bananas. The structure looks very similar to, say, oranges. I don't know if that's true, but you never eat oranges, but oranges could still come up because of that cross reactivity because they look, the proteins have a similar structure. So there is a complete lack of evidence to support making changes based off of food sensitivity test findings. The restrictions suggested by IgG test results may lead you to unnecessarily avoiding very healthy foods, actually giving you gaps in your diet, insufficiencies, deficiencies, because it's telling you to cut out so many healthful foods, foods that are good for you. And professional organizations that specialize in the treatment of food allergies and intolerances do not recommend IgG testing. This is why insurance companies will not cover the cost of these tests ever. Yeah.
This might be the funniest one today. A lot of these are like kind of actually crazy. This one's just hilarious to me.
Companies have capitalized off of this, what naturally happens in your body when you eat these foods. And they have literally looked at this and be like, oh, we could use that and manipulate it and tell people this is causing their gut health and their digestion problems.
It's just funny to me because every time I've ever heard about someone taking one of these tests, that's what they come back to me. Oh, well, I just found out that I was sensitive to everything that I was eating. Mm-hmm. So just coincidentally, everything I was eating and nothing I'm not. So I just had to completely flip-flop my diet.
Because you just have to completely change your diet. And the reason why, like, people are like, how can they get away with this? Food sensitivities are not clinically recognized. They're not medically or clinically recognized as an actual thing, a disease, a health ailment. So it's not like they're going against not being able to give this. It's not considered clinical advice or clinical recommendations because food sensitivities aren't a thing. You can feel, I don't want to discount, like, you can feel sensitive to foods. There's certain foods that individuals may eat and they may feel like, oh, this doesn't agree with me. I might be a little bit more sensitive to this type of food. You don't need to have a known reason for that. That's being intuitive with your diet and reflecting on, you know what? Certain foods just might not make me feel my best digestion-wise. Maybe I feel a little bit bloated after I eat certain foods. That is real. That happens from person to person. It's different from person to person. You can call that, I'm more sensitive to that. That is not a clinical diagnosis. It is not, it doesn't mean anything about your overall health medically. It's just what happens. Certain foods just don't agree with us and we don't need to have a diagnosis for that to be the case. It's just normal for certain foods to not agree with you.
So it's just funny to me what businesses people will make out of things like this.
Yeah.
It's laughable. It's bad, but it's that bad that it's laughable.
Yeah. And then people like more vulnerable populations and groups of people, like people with IBS. I have IBS. It sucks because there's not one answer to it. The solution is very individualized and not straightforward. You have to try a bunch of different things. And I can say, you know, certain, like too much fiber, my body is very sensitive to it because I have IBS-C. I don't have this food sensitivity to high fiber foods. I have IBS-C and I have to manage my diet a little bit different than the next person and be more cognizant of certain high fiber foods. That doesn't mean that these foods are doing anything wrong with me. It's just my underlying issue is I have IBS-C and there's certain things I have to do to manage it. But people want that quick, easy answer. Cut this food out, eat this, not that. Make your diet as limited as possible. And that's just not the way.
I was going to say, so it's probably not shocking because people will like swear by this and they're like, well, I took the test. I stopped eating what it told me to stop eating and my problems went away. Not really. Is it? I'm guessing it's because they probably erased whatever might have actually been causing the problem because they probably just wiped out their entire diet.
You're eating now such a limited diet.
I was going to say, like, if one or two of the hundreds of foods you were eating were causing the problems and you just wipe out all 100, congratulations, those one or two foods might not be there anymore. But your problem solved, but the other 90%+ you didn't have to get rid of. Is that kind of like what I'm guessing at?
And for a lot of people, maybe the first time they really start to pay attention to their diet. Not that this is the way to go, super restrictive, but they take this food sensitivity test and realize, shit, these are the foods I actually can eat. I'm going to have to cook a lot more meals at home.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like you start eating maybe more whole foods, less processed foods because of this. I mean, across the board, food sensitivity tests, like if you're eating a lot of processed foods, they're just in general going to recommend not to do that. But that's going to change how you feel overall. All the time, even if it's super restrictive and you go from eating more processed foods to mainly whole foods and cooking all of your meals, you're gonna feel fucking better. Like, you're just gonna feel better no matter what. So that's also a piece of it. But
I don't know how we're gonna try and top ourselves next week.
We will.
That was a banger of a list.
Yeah, that was a good one.
If you have questions, you know we're always here. You know, we always here, especially if you're over on Premium for the Friday AMAs. Again, that's just $5 if you want to sign up for that. Our AMAs, we'll talk to all you guys on Friday, a few days from now. And if you have any questions about this episode, shoot them. We can talk about it a little bit more in detail. Shoot them. But that's what we got for part one. We'll see you back next week for part two.